This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
It was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for downloading the World Tonight podcast on Tuesday, the 25th of February. A possible breakthrough in the relationship between the US and Ukraine. After President Zelensky and Trump have traded blows in the last week, Ukrainian officials say a minerals deal has been agreed between the two nations. We're live in Kyiv for the latest. Here in the UK, the Prime Minister pledges to boost defence spending. We'll examine how the extra funds will change the game militarily, politically and diplomatically. And take a look up at the night sky. There's a rare planetary parade. An astronomer talks us through how you can see it for yourself. All of that coming up on The World Tonight. Europe needs to pay more to protect its continent more. It's been a familiar refrain from President Trump, who for some time has called on European leaders to increase defence spending. Mr. Trump thinks America pays too much, Europe way too little. And it's against this backdrop, as leaders try to find a way to end the war in Ukraine, that the Prime Minister today pledged to increase Britain's military budget. At the moment, the UK pays 2.3% as a percentage of GDP. But today, Keir Starmer said he'll up that amount to 2.5% by 2027, with the pledge to get it to 3% in the next Parliament.
The great lesson of our history is that tyrants like Putin only respond to strength. So today I have announced the biggest sustained increase in defence spending since the end of the Cold War. We will keep our manifesto commitment to spend 2.5% of our GDP on defence. But in light of the grave threats that we face, we will bring forward that target so we meet it in 2027. That is an increase of £13.4 billion year on year compared to where we are today.
But at a time when spending is already stretched, the money does, of course, have to come from somewhere. Well, the Prime Minister announced he'd be making cuts to the foreign aid budget to pay for this, something he says he regretted. All of this comes as Keir Starmer leaves for Washington tomorrow, where he'll meet the US president later in the week. He's denied today's move was part of a plan to appease Donald Trump. Well, we'll be speaking to a leading Republican and supporter of Donald Trump to get his reaction to the PM's announcement in a moment. But first, let's assess how that extra money could be spent. I'm joined live now by former Chief of the General Staff and head of the British Army, Lord Richard Dannett. Welcome to The World Tonight, Lord Dannett. What's your reaction to what you heard from the Prime Minister today?
Well, many of us for a long time now have been advocating for an increase in defence spending. Successive governments have taken too many peace dividends really ever since the end of the Cold War. And the time has come when the realisation is with an aggressive Russia that's a proven aggressor and attacker of another sovereign country, so the time has come to take our defence seriously. So it is very welcome that at long last and very belatedly, this government, and it could have been the previous government, has decided that the time has come to turn the tanker around and to start to increase our defence expenditure. Now to go from 2.3% to 2.5% by 2027 is a welcome move in the right direction. But it is only that. It is a movement in the right direction. It is not the quantum that is required to make up the deficit across our air, land and maritime, space, cyberspace, communications, logistics and all the whole range of military capabilities that have been hollowed out over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So it's good news, it's in the right direction, but my goodness, it's not enough.
And Lord Dannett, given all that you've said there and that there's money that's needed in all of the different forces, what will be the priorities or what should the priorities be for this increased spending?
Well, I think we have to look first at what has brought all this into sharp focus. and that is the war in Ukraine. And it's tragic that after all the years of peace and freedom in Europe, that we now have a horrible, bloody, extraordinary, tragic land war in Europe. So we have to look at our land warfare capability and those that support it, which is communications, air support, logistics, command and control, to make sure that if we get involved in some kind of confrontation like that in the future, we are ready, capable, and able. But the whole point is, and that's the whole argument behind increasing our defence expenditure, is to increase our military capability in order to deter further aggression from Russia,
And just
to
on
make
that
sure that
note,
the price to be paid by Russia is too high to even risk it.
Sir Keir Starmer has talked about the UK sending troops for any sort of peacekeeping force that might be in Ukraine. Would this money help fund that? And is it plausible and affordable to commit to something like that?
Well, it entirely depends on what the shape and mission of a peacekeeping or peace intervention force might be. I think it's by most analysts' view, which I share, to think that we could interpose forces along a 1,000-kilometer front line between Russian and Ukrainian troops is really impractical. It would require, we always say, a better part of 100,000 troops. Britain might have to supply 5,000 to 10,000 troops. And in the way we do these things, it would tie up 20,000 or 30,000 troops for the British Army, and frankly, we haven't got them. So if there's going to be some kind of peacekeeping effort, it's going to be a different nature. It might be aerial surveillance from satellites, from drones, from manned aircraft. It might be just a reassurance mission within the towns and cities and villages of Ukraine. We don't know, but it's a bold offer to be prepared to put British boots on the ground when our small army is extraordinarily busy anyway. And the other thing to remember, it's one thing to go into a peacekeeping operation, but my goodness, history shows us it takes us a long time to come out of it. The Americans have been in Korea since 1953 and have 25,000 troops there. We were 38 years in Northern Ireland, Kosovo in 1999. There are still NATO troops there. So we rush into these things, but we've got to be able to sustain them, and that's going to cost money.
Indeed, lots to digest there. Lord Richard Dannett, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. Now, the news that the foreign aid budget would be cut to pay for the increase in defence spending has been met with a mixed reaction. During the general election, the Labour Party manifesto said it was committed to restoring development spending at the level of 0.7% of gross national income, as soon as fiscal circumstances allow. Now, that figure will go down to 0.3%. Sarah Champion's a Labour MP and chair of the International Development Committee.
The announcement today shocked and pained me because it's not only the Labour manifesto that made a commitment to restore the aid budget, it was also the Conservative and the Lib Dems as well. So it's sort of shame on all of our houses today, I'm afraid. And I don't feel any safer going to bed tonight than I did when I got up this morning.
Is that shock and pain that you describe something that other Labour colleagues are also telling you they're feeling tonight?
I think so. I mean, universally, I haven't found anyone who disagrees on investing more in our defence. I think for decades, our forces have been under-resourced, understaffed, and to be honest, underappreciated in many cases. So I'm really pleased that we're now acknowledging just how important they are. But unfortunately, to fund it through the poorest in the world, I think is a mistake. People don't really understand what development is, and it's actually about people keeping people safe in their own houses. So it's about protecting people from conflict. It's about challenging unstable governments. It's about giving voice to civil society to hold politicians in check. It's about enabling people to grow enough food so that they don't face famine. And it's about keeping people in their homes and trying to make climate adaptation so they don't have to leave. All of that is early intervention. Without all of that, we will see more conflict happening. And that's what scares me. If we don't do the early intervention, this measure could put us all more at risk.
But I guess the question is, if you do think that defence spending needs to be boosted, the money has to come from somewhere, and there are difficult choices right now.
Absolutely. But what I would say is to take it all out of sort of the first line of defence we have in the form of supporting other countries around the world seems very short-sighted.
But then where does it come from, Sarah?
Well, I mean, the reality is that even with the cuts to aid, we're still far short of the 0.5 that we need to meet this target of 3%. So people need to understand that there are going to be cuts or tax rises potentially as a consequence of this, and tough choices are going to have to be made. But one of the ones that actually worries me is Ukraine is currently the main country, the biggest country benefiting from our aid programme. So I really hope an unintended consequence of this isn't that we start cutting the support we're giving to Ukraine.
Some of the Prime Minister's critics might argue that they see that he's done this just as he heads to meet President Trump in Washington. Is that a feeling that you have, that he's done this to sweeten Mr. Trump?
I genuinely don't know, but I would say it's quite a coincidence that it's come out just 2 days before the meeting. I can't say that the cuts are a surprise. I do say that it's very surprising that they weren't part of the spring statement, which is coming out at the end of next month. That's where I was anticipating them. So the timing does make it seem as though it's part of the bigger picture of the meeting.
Sarah Champion there. Well, as we've been saying, Sir Keir Starmer sets off tomorrow on his trip to Washington, D.C. to meet President Trump on Thursday. Well, today's announcement is likely to get those meetings off to a good start, if the reaction from President Trump's defence secretary is anything to go by. This evening, Pete Hegseth said the boost in UK defence spending was a strong step from an enduring partner. Well, Pete Sessions is a Republican congressman from Texas who's the co-chair of the House DOGE, that is, of course, Department of Government Efficiency, grouping. Welcome to The World Tonight, Mr. Sessions. I want to start by asking you what your reaction is to this announcement from Sir Keir Starmer that the UK is going to increase defence spending.
There was a question mark that went with that about was that something that was done to help the conversation with President Trump. I think it was. You're having to face the same issues that we are in the United States, and that is making decisions where we would place our priorities. And I think the United States wants to have a closer and better relationship with Great Britain, our dear friends, and our president believes that that's one of the curried favors that comes with that, and that is Europe taking a little bit more responsibility for Europe and their own safety.
Is this enough responsibility, Congressman? Because we know that the president has actually asked for European nations to stump up a lot more money, more in the region of 5%.
Well, in fact, he did. And you remember 8 years ago, he began that same conversation. And then over the years, it filtered through to everybody that there was a reason why. And I think accepting this responsibility is good for a safer world and certainly better in dealing with this from President Trump's perspective. I want America and Great Britain to be close friends, allies, patriots together. They have worked together. We have seemingly since for many years, 80, 90 years, very closely. And this relationship needs to continue. But we need to also recognize that in doing this, we have responsibilities for the larger world. And that's where President Trump is placing the brakes on what that will be for the United States.
You talk about wanting to make sure that the US and the UK continue to have a strong relationship, but things have been a little bit awkward between President Trump and many of his European allies over the way that he's handled talks about ways to end the war in Ukraine. For example, freezing so far Mr. Zelensky out of the conversation. How do you think that's going to impact some of the conversations this week?
Well, it's been baffling to a number of people in this country who had understood the relationship going back to President Reagan and the conflict with the evil empire, Russia, I think that President Trump is now trying to open up a new dialogue. I must be open about this. While I go back to Ronald Reagan and apply many of the things to that, we now have the new adversary in town, and that's China. And I think President Trump is bringing forth some ideas that I need to learn to pay attention to and listen to him about.
But was he right to freeze Mr. Zelensky out so far?
Well, the orbit that he's going to now is to pull Russia away from their closeness to China. And unfortunately, it seems like that has been the cautionary tale that would be told, that evidently he was going to change verbiage about who attacked who and who needed who. But America still needs to be careful, in my opinion, but I'm willing to listen to the president.
Okay, so you think he's taking a risky strategy, but let's talk about the news that's just come into us this evening, and that is that we understand from Ukrainian officials that a minerals deal has been agreed between your country and Ukraine. And we're hearing reports that President Zelensky may even go to Washington by the end of the week to sign that agreement. Can you confirm that, first of all? And secondly, how significant do you see this, given everything we've just talked about?
Well, Ukraine has these opportunities. The United States really approached them and asked that this be part of the conversation probably in November. And the Ukrainians, in my opinion, had not yet come to the point where they are today. I'm delighted. I think it gives us an opportunity to get a partnership again with them, and it gives Ukraine money in their pockets.
A partnership after a bit of a war of words between President Trump and President Zelensky.
No question about it. No question.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, Pete Session, Republican congressman and, of course, co-chair of the House DOGE Caucus.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
Well, it's very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music recording with Brian Eno and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming up here on The World Tonight, a rare alignment of planets in the night sky. I venture out to the broadcasting house balcony to hear from an astronomer on why it matters.
There is a lot to learn in the sky. We are all made out of atoms, and those atoms came from the stars billions of years ago. In that cloud that formed the planets and formed the Earth, and we come from there.
Now, you may remember the story of a baby who was found abandoned in a plastic bag in East London when she was just hours old. Elsa was discovered by a dog walker on the coldest night of January 2024. Hospital staff named her after the character in the Disney cartoon Frozen. Back then, it was hard to imagine how things would turn out for baby Elsa after such an early trauma. But a year on, and a family court has heard that she's not just thriving, she's also taken her first steps. The judge said it was astonishing that the baby was doing so well. Well, Elsa was the third child of the same parents to be abandoned within 7 years. Her plight's a reminder of the challenges facing abandoned children and their care, even if cases are extremely rare. Well, the British Olympian Fatima Whitbread was abandoned as a baby, and she now runs her own charities to support children in the care system. She joins me now, as does Lorraine Scher, Professor of Clinical Psychology at London's Royal Free Hospital, who works to support abandoned babies. Welcome to both of you. I'm going to start with you, Fatima. It's a very personal story to share. One, of course, that's probably had much trauma as well. But now you're trying to funnel a lot of your experience into your charity. Just tell us a bit about your story.
Well, I was abandoned as a baby, and some would have said left to die. A neighbour heard a baby crying in a flat and hadn't seen anybody coming or going to the flat in a few days. So she called the police and they came and banged the door down and rescued the baby, which was myself. And then I spent the next 7 months recovering in hospital from malnutrition. And during that 7 months, then I was made a ward of court by Hackney Borough Council, of which saw me in the care system then for the next 14 years of my life. So it's particularly nice to know that Elsa and the other two children have been adopted, because I think this is the kindest way for children to live their life. You know, everybody wants to be have unconditional love, and those that don't suffer greatly from trauma. And the great problem that we have is most of these children arrive in the care system through no fault of their own. But what they have in common is that they do suffer with trauma. They have abandonment issues, neglect, and, you know, often, you know, without that unconditional love, it can be a real struggle for them. And for me, it was no different. But my ministry today is to bring together the collaboration and partnership of the four nations in harnessing the power of one voice. And we have a summit coming up this April on the 23rd and 24th at the Guildhall in London to improve the life outcomes for children and young people. It has to be said that in the 60 years since I was in the care system, and back then it was very little spoken about children's needs.
Right.
Emotional needs are very rarely met.
And Fatima, when you hear about stories like baby Elsa's, of course, as we said in that introduction, it's extremely rare. But what do you think about when you hear, or when you heard last year, about the discovery of baby Elsa and the way that she was found?
Well, it's shocking, really. I mean, and very sad. But you never really understand or know the conditions of why a mother would do that to their child, whether she's suffering from mental health issues or, you know, some form of addiction. Who would do that? You know, at the end of the day, it has to be something that's amiss for that to go on. But you know, it was nice to hear just recently that she's doing exceptionally well, and she survived that. She's thriving now, and she's got that love and security. And really, that's what we all want, isn't it? You know, for our children to have the love and security of a good home.
Indeed. Let me bring Lorraine in, if I may. You work a lot with abandoned babies. What is the biggest challenge that you come across?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is really to underscore what Fatima was saying, is that the children will need family. And we have good evidence based that family and loving care is the thing they need. And they need it continually. And the other issues are learning and understanding about their abandonment, about their past. They're very often little infants, but when is it disclosed to them? When do they find out? In what circumstances? And our research with adults who were abandoned as babies has pointed very clearly that it's a lifelong burden they carry on their shoulders.
And so when they find out is key, you're saying?
Well, in our research, absolutely. Some of them only found out later, but some of them found out on occasions of, say, a wedding or a death. Some of them were never told. And the ones who are the most well-adapted are those who always knew. So
interesting.
The idea is that the children should be told the truth, and they should be told the truth always, and not have a moment of disclosure, which is quite a shock for a child.
Indeed, Lorraine. I just want to end this really important discussion by bringing Fatima back in. Fatima, just listening to what Lorraine said, when did you find out, and, you know, how did you get help to sort of process that?
Well, it's, again, there's two areas here for me. Obviously, as in my primary care years, I mean, obviously, I always say that children can get damaged and are damaged, and sometimes set up for failure as well, because the care system doesn't handle things properly. It's really difficult. I mean, back in my period of time, children should be seen and not heard, and we were really, our emotional needs were rarely met, and nobody ever explained to me within the first 5 years of my life that I had a mother, or did I have any visits or any cards, birthday cards or anything to indicate mm-hmm. there was anybody out there.
Okay.
And it was quite a shock to me then to be told at 5 years old, be ready to be picked up tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock to move to a new children's home where you would by your mother to meet your half brother and sister. Now, I would like to think that doesn't happen now, but I do believe it has changed slightly, mm-hmm. but not a lot. And what we'd like to do is make sure that these children, from the minute they come into the care system throughout and beyond,
okay.
are handled properly in the way they deal with, in processing.
Okay.
Emotional.
I'm so sorry to have to cut this discussion short, because we could talk for hours about this really important subject, but we have unfortunately run out of time. But thank you so much, Fatima Whitbread, for sharing your personal story and some of the challenges. And thank you as well to Lorraine Scher. Now to the news of a mineral deal which has been agreed between the US and Ukraine. It follows a week where, as we know, there's been a war of words between Presidents Trump and Zelensky. Well, let's go straight to Kyiv and join our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse. James, first of all, just take us through what this deal might look like.
Well, against the backdrop of quite hostile rhetoric, where you had Donald Trump labelling President Zelensky as a dictator, where he blamed Ukraine for starting Russia's invasion. I mean, now we have seemingly an area of cooperation where we've had sources at the presidential office say that this is a mineral deal that now favours Ukraine. If you look at the reports, it suggests that the US has climbed down from its demand of accessing $500 billion worth of Ukraine's natural minerals. Now it seems, again according to reports, the details are scant, is that America will have a stake in a pot of money that will come from Ukrainian profits, from Ukrainian minerals, oil and gas. And the hope here is that it'll give America a reason, an interest to defend against Russia's continued occupation of Ukrainian territory. What you often hear is Ukraine wanting security guarantees, boots on the ground, financial support, artillery, ammunition, for example. At the moment, we don't have those kind of specifics from the US, but the hope is that this agreement now might pave the way for America to have more of an active role in Ukraine's continued existence as a sovereign nation, albeit with Russia on its own territory. So it is a breakthrough, but okay. There is a long way to go, and it's the first area of cooperation.
Okay, thank you so much, James Waterhouse in Kyiv, for that update. Now, survivors of a prison fire in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in which around 132 women and 26 children burned to death, have told the BBC they want justice but don't expect to get it. It's believed the fire was started by male inmates who were trying to flee the jail in Goma last month. The eastern city was the focus of fierce fighting as a paramilitary group backed by neighbouring Rwanda, known as the M23 rebels, rapidly advanced through the region. Up to 4,000 men are thought to have broken out of the prison, but few of the women escaped. Many were raped by male inmates, according to survivors. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, reports from Goma, and a warning that you may find some details distressing.
I'm just walking into the women's wing, or what's left of it. You can see all around evidence of how intense the blaze was. There are burn marks here on all the walls, and lots of ash at my feet. And there are a lot of belongings strewn around here. Piles of clothing, lots of cooking utensils. On the ground I can see a copy of the Bible. And everywhere, marks of the flames. You can just imagine what was endured by the women and children who were trapped here locked in, unable to get away. Two survivors from the women's prison have come back for the first time. They want to tell their story. In silence, they walk through the charred ruins. 22-year-old Pascaline has her hand to her mouth in horror. Nadine, who is 23, is soon in tears. Pascaline, can you tell me what happened to you that night?
I was raped by two men. Violently. And passed out. While the second man was raping me, I came to. He told me he would kill me if I tried to escape. I was forced to let it happen, instead of losing my life. The unlucky ones were raped. The lucky ones got out without being raped.
That night, the prison was engulfed by chaos and by fire. Most of the guards long gone. By morning, thousands of the men had managed to break free. But the women were still trapped. Among them, Nadine, who was raped by two men and saw women and children dying around her. Nadine, can you tell me how have you been coping since the attack?
When I sleep at night, I see scenes of everything I've seen here coming back to me. I see the dead again, as many dead bodies as I saw here until I got out. Maybe through you, someone can help us find justice, because we've suffered a bad savagery.
Do you have any faith in justice here in the DRC?
I don't, because instead of helping us, they were the ones who closed the door. Instead of opening the door, they let us die like animals in this prison.
I'm just coming into a tent in the grounds of a hospital in Goma. I've come here to meet a 25-year-old woman, Sifa Mohammed. Sifa was badly burned in the fire in the prison. Her right arm is very heavily bandaged. There's a bandage on her left hand. And you can see burn marks on her arm and on her face. She was in prison without being convicted of anything, she says. And she was with her 2-year-old daughter, Esther.
We were woken from our sleep by a fire in the middle of the night. We started to scream, "Fire! Help! We will die in this prison." But there was no one there and the doors were padlocked shut. There were no night watchmen. They had all gone.
Sifa, I'm sorry to ask this question, but can you tell me what happened to your daughter, Esther?
I had her on my back when we wanted to escape. Something fell on her. Was it a bomb? I don't know. She died on the spot.
The full story of what happened in the prison may never be known. Sifa says no one is looking for the truth. She and the other survivors we spoke to have not been contacted by anyone. Not the rebels in control in Goma now, nor the government in Kinshasa, which used to run the prison.
We asked the government in Kinshasa for a response to what the survivors told us, but so far haven't had a response. Now, as soon as you've finished listening to the programme, why not step outside to take a look at a rare astronomical phenomenon? A planetary parade is a chance to see all seven of the other planets in the solar system. I went to have a look earlier. The reason I've come up to this balcony is because I'm joined by Dr. Francisco Diego, who is a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society and a lecturer at UCL. And we've come up here to see what's known as a planetary parade. So we're looking out at the night sky. What are we looking for?
Well, we are looking west. It's a lovely sunset. It's a very clear evening.
We should be able to see Mercury and Saturn just setting there. I think they have set already. Very difficult to see them because they are very faint and very close to the sun as we see them from here. However, above them, we see the brightest object in the night sky, which is the planet Venus.
That's Venus there?
Over there, yes.
And it's really bright, isn't it?
I mean, it's almost frightening bright. I mean, this is why the ancient civilizations are fear of the planets. They look at you with very, very steady light, kind of almost menacing. They don't twinkle like the stars do. So they have the names of gods. And in this case, a goddess, Venus, the god of love and beauty. You can see why, because it's such a lovely light. And it is by far it's the brightest thing we have in the sky.
I mean, it's remarkable, yeah. Really, because yeah. You can see planes in the distance flying in the background, but yeah. Venus is just there twinkling.
It doesn't look like it belongs to the sky, because it's so different from all the objects in the sky. And above Venus, you will see Jupiter.
So basically, tonight, if people are doing this themselves, if they go left and a bit up, that's when, from Venus, they'll see Jupiter.
Yes, you're facing south, say, you look on your right, will be the west. And then above your head, as high as possible in the sky, you will see the planet Jupiter. And then if you carry on along that line, you will find another one, which is a little bit fainter, because it's now getting away from us, you're getting fainter, but you will notice the color.
That's red. Is that Mars?
Yeah,
that's Mars.
That is Mars there.
You do have your binoculars hanging around your neck.
Yes.
Can I have a go?
Yeah,
quickly?
Just have a go.
There we go. I can see there. Yes. I can see Jupiter. And I'm just going to try and see if I can see Venus through these as well. Oh, yes, there it is.
Keep the binoculars because now you're going to see Mars.
No, I don't think I can actually. The problem with these binoculars is trying to find where things are. And a minute ago, I just caught the London Eye by mistake, which definitely is not Mars. But more generally,
yes.
How rare is this?
It is very rare. To have the seven planets above the horizon, so you could see them simultaneously, is very rare. And I must say, this is not only tonight. Jupiter and Mars will be there for a long time. I mean, for another couple of months.
And what's the big lesson for you as an astronomer from all of this that we've seen?
It's important to notice the movement of the planets and remember that we are moving as well. There is a lot to learn in the sky. All what we have on this planet and everything, we are all made out of atoms. And those atoms came from the stars billions of years ago in that cloud that formed the planets and formed the Earth. And we come from there. So essentially, it's nice to recognize and to acknowledge that we are certainly stardust. And in the future, we will be stardust again.
Okay, I'm going to take one more look at Venus before I go back into the warm studio. Thank you very much. And on that note, we end this edition of The World Tonight.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
It was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.